Welcome to episode 3 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast. On the day of the solar eclipse, when we won't be able to see anything for a little while, apparently, it's Randy Wilkins, and I am joined by two people today. We have our first guest. Well, first, as always, I'm joined by Yankees beat reporter from The Athletic, Chris Kirshner. Chris, how are you?
I am doing well. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Can't complain. The weather's better. The sun is going to go away for a while, but the Yankees are looking good, so I'm feeling good. So also, I watched WrestleMania and got into a lot of arguments with people on Twitter about silly things like wrestling, so that was fun. So yeah, it was good.
I haven't watched wrestling in maybe 20 years, I would
really
say. Yeah, I just stopped getting into it when, like, I think as soon as I learned it was fake, like when I was a kid, I was like, what's the point?
Chris, it's real. It's very real. don't ever say that again. yeah, WrestleMania was great for those that watched. It was entertaining. Cody Rhodes won. Didn't really want him to win, but we'll see what happens. Anyway, we have our first guest, and we're very excited to have him. Also covering the Yankees for the Daily News, it's Gary Phillips. Gary, welcome to the pod. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Honored to be the first guest. I never got into wrestling. I've heard it's not real, though, Randy.
It's very real, Gary. We're not starting off on the right foot here. It's very real. It's very real. It's scripted, but they are.
There we go. There we
scripted.
Go.
Scripted. But it's very real. So yeah, thanks for joining us. Very excited to have you. Our goal is to have guests throughout the season from all kind of backgrounds and contributions to the game. Hopefully some people with the Yankees, but we're very excited to have Gary. Gary was at the stadium this weekend covering a series with the Blue Jays. Chris was at a wedding. And Tim is already making his impact on the podcast.
He doesn't like that I was at the wedding.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't like that you were at the wedding at all. He's very unhappy about that. He has some concerns and complaints. But yeah, Gary was at the stadium and saw the Yankees firsthand for their first series in the Bronx. So, Gary, what were your before we get into the topics for this episode, what was your read on the team, the crowd, the locker room? What was your sense of where the club was at during that first opening series at home?
Well, the home opener was very weird because we had that earthquake right before the game during batting practice. So a lot of players and fans' attention were, you know, what's going on? What was that? Some guys felt it, other guys didn't. I was out on the field. I didn't feel a thing. Suddenly I'm getting texts from my editor right about the earthquake, which I had no idea had occurred. So that was a challenge, but it was a good crowd, you know, all weekend. I think it was a little bit better on Saturday than during the opener on Friday, just because it was a little chilly Friday. It's a weekday afternoon game. So I thought it was a little bit light for an opening day, so to speak, but it was a good vibe all weekend. The club seems very relaxed, very confident. You know, there was a lot of swagger oozing out of that first road trip, which I thought continued into this first home, you know, the start of this first homestand. So I'd say vibes are still pretty good right now. And, you know, that remains the case after the weekend when you win another series and you do it in a variety of ways.
So I have a question about that. And Chris, you could chime in too, since obviously you're around the team. When you say that they have a swagger about them, what exactly does that look like? How does it manifest itself? Just so people have a better understanding of how it plays out and what it looks like tangibly, rather than just the idea of like, okay, they have more swagger than maybe compared to last year. But what does that look like? What does that feel like?
I think it does start with comparison, not only to last year, but also kind of this traditional buttoned up Yankee way, right? Like there's a lot more personality in this room and you see it on the field. And I think the new guys, Soto, Stroman, Verdugo, have a huge, huge impact on it. But it's not just them. You heard Clark Schmidt after his start in Houston make some bold declarations. You know, we're here. This is just the start for us. You've seen Aaron Judge in his outfield celebrations really matching the energy of Soto and Verdugo. And then you've got Soto pounding his chest, screaming anytime he does something good. You've got Verdugo dropping all these colorful sound bites after game. So it's just very different from the traditional Yankee way, at least in my opinion. That's how I've observed it and kind of internalized it. I think, you know, just going through social media and looking back at these, you know, first week or so of games, it's very evident that others feel the same way. But I don't know. Chris, what do you think?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's night and day different just from what we experienced last year. Last year, it just seemed like the locker room was dead for the most part. Just there was no, I mean, probably because the team just wasn't performing well, but it just didn't seem like the vibes were that high, even from the start of the season. And I know we spoke to Garrett about that in Arizona. I think I was the one who asked him, just, you know, do the vibes feel different? And, you know, he agreed with that assessment. I just think it's, I think the new guys have definitely brought a different, much needed energy that was lacking from last season. And even going back to 2022, when I was around the team at that point, starting in August, it just feels much different. I don't know if it's that, if it's going to translate to, you know, success moving forward. Obviously they've started off well, so it's hard not to have the vibes be high when they're 8-2 as we're recording this. So we'll see if it continues, but I think right now it's certainly encouraging that it seems like everybody's getting along. The new guys are fitting in seamlessly. No one is having any issues in the clubhouse. But again, it's April 8th as we're recording this. Let's see where we're at in, you know, mid-July.
So one guy that seems to have some good vibes going with him right now and maybe having a nice departure from last year, which was a total disaster for him on a individual level, just with his performance last year and overall physical well-being, it appeared, is Giancarlo Stanton, who I think besides Volpe might have had the best series out of anybody on the Yankees over the weekend. And obviously there was a big power display. He looked a little bit like vintage Giancarlo Stanton. So the question I have for the both of you, and Gary, you can start with this. Do you get the sense that this is the beginning of maybe a comeback type season where it's sustained throughout the entire year? Or does this feel like the beginning of one of these Stanton hot streaks that's going to quickly turn into a cold streak and then people start asking questions about the viability of his standing with the team moving forward? Where do you land on that, just based off the last couple games and how he's looked, how he looked against Toronto?
I don't want to hedge here, but it's too soon to know. You know, he's been such a streaky hitter throughout his career, when he's had good seasons, when he's had bad seasons. You know, so he ended spring training on a really hot streak. Then he starts off the regular season by leading the American League in strikeouts before he goes on this two-game tear, you know, over the weekend. So it's tough with him. You know, he's a guy who's got a swing that really lends itself to that streakiness. I will say that he looks like he's in way better shape. You know, he really revamped his body over the offseason. So far, it's allowed him to stay on the field. It's allowed him to look a little more nimble. You know, he's not going to suddenly be a burner or, you know, a defensive whiz who can run down fly balls or steal bases or anything like that. But he does look like he's moving a little bit better. So I think the hope there for him and for the Yankees is that that allows him to at least stay on the field and produce. So at the bare minimum, maybe you're looking at more of these hot streaks over the course of the season, and he ends up with overall numbers that look a lot better than the last two seasons. But it's still a very small sample size, this two-game stretch that he's on at the time of recording. So if you look back at the last 2 years, that's a lot bigger of a sample size. So I don't want to say he's back just yet, but it's encouraging right now.
I will say that, you know, with Stanton, he's always had the ability to hit, you know, massive home runs and get everybody excited over that continuing for over the course of the season. I know on episode one, I said, you know, he was my bold prediction of, you know, playing 130 games and hitting 35 home runs. The thing with Stanton, though, it's never been – the issue hasn't been hitting home runs. It's everything else. You know, it's the lack of running. It's the lack of being able to play the field because of he can't run and because there's always the injury risk that hovers over him. So, yeah, I mean, it was nice to see him have success and results over the weekend, but – you know, I'm looking at the stats here. You know, so far this season, he's faced 72 fastballs. He has 3 hits in 18 at-bats that have ended in a fastball. He struck out on 47.4% of those at-bats that end in fastballs. He's hitting under 200. So, you know, that doesn't lend itself to much optimism. You know, last season, he really struggled with pitches over 95 miles an hour. He has 0 hits against pitches over 95 miles an hour this season so far. The home runs that he's hit, one of them was against Kevin Gausman, who I don't know what was going on with him. You know, his fastball was, I think, over 3 miles an hour lower than what it usually is. Yeah, everything was lower. Yeah, the fastball he hit out against Gausman was like 91 miles an hour. And then on Sunday against Bowden Francis, that was 93 miles an hour. I think the one encouraging thing about Stanton's homer against Francis is, you know, he pulled it, and there was no doubt about that home run. And last season, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't turning on fastballs like he showed on Sunday. So I do think that is an encouraging sign. But, you know, I'm just looking at the stats themselves so far, they're not very encouraging overall. And, you know, 2 games is obviously small. Even 10 games that the Yankees have played is a small sample, but that's all we're going off of so far. So I would say that, you know, these 2 games for me don't really mean much of anything, because what we've seen so far over the larger sample so far is that he's kind of the same. And I personally haven't really seen much of a difference with his swing. You know, the running that Gary mentioned, I'm looking now, last year he was averaging 24.4 feet per second. This year it's up to 24.8 feet per second. So he's basically the same speed, even though he's lost weight and looks to be, you know, thinner. You know, he's always been in great shape. His body's made of stone. So I wouldn't say that, you know, these 2 games mean much of anything for me so far, just because of the fact that, you know, the overall results, especially the inability to hit fastballs consistently and the fastballs that are, you know, high velocity are still, you know, an issue so far.
Yeah, I tried asking Boone yesterday, because Boone's been saying since Arizona or since Houston, you know, Stanton's right there. He's in the at-bats. The juice is there. He's going to get hot. Just give him time. So now that he got hot over these 2 games, I tried asking Boone post-game yesterday, you know, when you say Stanton, or anybody for that matter, is close, what are you basing that on? And I was kind of hoping Boone would say something along the lines of, well, I'm watching his pitch recognition. I'm watching the quality of his swing, the quality of the contact, the quality of the pitches that he's doing damage on. And Boone kind of just said, well, you know, I based it on watching the game and didn't really provide all that much insight. But these are all things to consider. You know, Chris went over the velocity issues and all that. Like, those are all things to think about when you're trying to assess or predict what Stanton's going to do for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I'll push back a little bit just so for the sake of conversation. But also, I do think there are a couple things at play that might not necessarily make me feel encouraged that he's going to have like this big like comeback player of the year type season, but one that will be more productive than last year. One of them, Chris, is what you mentioned just with him pulling the ball. I don't really remember him last year. I'm sure he obviously did. I mean, it's like impossible not to do it, but I don't really remember many big home runs just in terms of like just high quality contact that he was able to pull, even though like it wasn't an elite fastball from Francis. I think him being able to tattoo a ball like that for a pitch that he just a lot of times last year he fouled off, it felt like, or he just like straight swung through it. I thought it was something that was encouraging. I also like that the first home run was an opposite field home run. So it just feels like in terms of point of contact, again, as we all noted, it's super small sample size. This could go away very quickly as it came to be over the last couple games. I do like that the point of contact is varied and allowed him to be productive on all parts of the field. I also think just his role on this team doesn't necessarily require him to get back to some like high level athleticism. I don't really know how many games he's going to play in the outfield. Like I just don't view him as an outfield option. I think they have much better depth now, which kind of limits the ceiling of usage for him. To me, it's just go right now. For me, it's just be the power hitter in the lineup, kind of be like the old school slugger, be there in the middle of the lineup, hit a bunch of home runs, and you've made your contribution. I just think that because the team is better around him, I think it limits the exposure and the necessity of Stan being able to do things that he probably isn't capable of doing anymore with any type of consistency. So the sprint speed obviously is going to be an issue at times. Hopefully he can go from second to home or first to third every once in a while. So I think that will show up when he's on a base pass. But in terms of anything beyond that, like playing the field, unless everybody starts getting hurt again, that doesn't really bother me as much. I just don't think there's as much of a need for Stan to be placed in those situations. So I'm trying to find the positives in what we've seen in the last couple of days. The velocity is still going to be the ultimate test, I think.
Yeah.
Like if you know, as the season goes on, gets a little warmer, you know, if he can start to show that he can start to hit that high velocity again, then I think that he's in a pretty good place.
I will add, I looked it up when you were talking. Last season, 35 at-bats ended in a pulled fastball. Seven of those went for home runs. I mean, I think I wrote it in October after the season. You know, one area that Stanton could certainly improve is if he just pulls more fly balls, if he still has the ability to. You know, 35 at-bats ending in a that were a fastball, it's not a lot. That's 2% of all the pitches.
That is really low.
Yeah, it's extremely low. Yeah, 2%. And seven of them went for home runs out of the 35 at-bats. I mean, Stanton's powers is, you know, unbelievable. If he can just pull the ball in the air, it's a good possibility that it's going to leave the park. But his problem really for his career is, you know, even though we know Stanton as one of, you know, his generation's best power hitters, he hits the ball on the ground so much. He's really a ground ball hitter, not a fly ball hitter. If he could just change his swing a little bit to elevate the ball more, he would have way more success. It's just, I don't know if it's too late in his career to, you know, reinvent his, you know, bat path to, you know, kind of sell out for the home run, because a lot of his home runs are the line drives, the patented line drives that like scrape the wall. The one that he hit against Gausman is really what he's been known for. But if he can just elevate the ball more, he would have so much more success.
Yeah. Is it even a case of selling out for the home run, or just like kind of tweaking the bat path a little bit? I mean, it seems, because he's so strong and so powerful, it feels even more simple than that. Like, just not necessarily in execution, but maybe in like a general approach, is that if I do something to alter my bat path just a little bit, you know, I can pull these balls in the air and have way better production. You know, he's so interesting to me, because it feels like there's a lot to discuss about him, but also it seems like very straightforward at the same time. Like, pull the ball in the air more, Giancarlo Stanton, you're going to hit a lot of home runs, you know?
Right.
But also there's so many other factors, like his physical well-being, you know, has age caught up to him? Is it more than like, is it also related to mechanical stuff with his swing? He's like complex and simple at the same time in an odd way to me.
I mean, he has a unique swing. Like no one swings the bat like he does, because it kind of looks like it's all arms.
Right.
I mean, it's work for him because, you know, he has a case for, you know, making the Hall of Fame one day. If he has a couple more good seasons, like, you know, he's going to be in the conversation for sure. It's worked for, you know, the decade plus that he's been in the league. Obviously it hasn't worked well the past couple of years. I don't know if that's just because of the amount of injuries he's had, especially with his lower body. He's not able to use his lower body as well as, you know, he would like, because like even still with him, you know, telling us in spring training that he changed his swing, looks the same to me. I don't know what you think, Gary. It looks the exact same to me.
Yeah, I still see.
There's a few things that are different for sure, like the way he's set up. But like when he actually swings the bat, it looks the exact same.
Yeah, the setup in the box looks slightly adjusted, but right. Once he actually starts the swing, the mechanics, it still looks all arms to me. it still looks, you know, even when he's making contact and he's making solid contact, it still looks like a hack more than a swing. I don't know if listeners can really like picture the difference there, but it's just all arms, and you see it very clearly when he misses on a pitch or he chases a pitch that's well out of the strike zone. But there are times, even this past weekend when he had success, where he's hitting rockets and I'm like, how? He's only using his arms. Like you see it in just the bat path and the arm movement. You see it. It's pretty noticeable. It's a really unique swing. Like Chris said, it's gotten him this far. It's gotten him to this point of being a borderline Hall of Famer. I just wonder if he needs more serious adjustments at this stage in his career when he's not catching up to the velocity. And while we're on the subject of Stanton, there's one other thing I want to bring up that I think gets overlooked a lot. And I know me and Chris have talked about this, so that's why I bring it up. Like, if he just got on base a little bit more, that would be a huge improvement, or at least a marginal improvement to what he's done over the last 2 years. You know, this is a guy with an on career on base percentage close to 350, and he's been under 300 the last two seasons, you know, 2022, 2023. So if he can improve the pitch recognition, at the very least, he might be getting on base a little bit more at a higher clip, and it would probably set him up for a little bit more success when it comes to doing damage, hitting the ball out of the ballpark, recognizing velocity. But that just hasn't happened. You know, even this past weekend with success, you know, you're seeing that he's still striking out. He's still chasing a little bit. So
why do you guys think his pitch recognition has declined so rapidly over the last couple of years? Do you think it's compensation for maybe a loss of bat speed and being conscious of catching up the velocity and selling out a little bit more? Is it just the way pitchers have approached him over the years and he just hasn't made the adjustment? What do you guys think contributes to that decline in pitch recognition? Because I agree. I mean, it's very obvious that that's a problem for him. It might be leading to some of the production issues just overall. Where do you think those problems come from?
I think it's a combination of those things. You know, I'm sure he is aware of his struggles with velocity over the last few seasons, so he might be a little jumpier in the box and, you know, trying to start his swing up a little bit earlier. On the flip side, pitchers have gotten so, so good over the last few years at tunneling and, you know, disguising their repertoire, just, you know, using deception. So if you know, hey, this guy might be a little bit jumpy because he can't catch up to the fastball, but perhaps you don't have the greatest fastball in the game, okay, you're going to be more inclined to throw him breaking stuff. If he shows that he's willing to chase because the pitch recognition is not there, you're just going to throw what would normally be considered a waste pitch. You're going to throw it outside of the zone, but you're not, you know, with him, there's a fairly decent shot he's going to go after it.
Yeah.
Chris, I mean, what do you think?
I think it's exactly what Gary said. You know, there's been some public data over the past couple of years where it shows Stanton has lost bat speed. He's still the, you know, he still swings the bat the fastest in Major League Baseball, but, you know, the loss of bat speed, especially with a swing like his, could certainly lead to, you know, exaggerated results, which is what we've seen over these past couple of seasons. So I do wonder, you know, if that has anything to do with his lack of being able to hit high velocity pitches anymore, just because he has such an interesting swing. It's not really like anyone else's in the sport. So I think it's probably the fact that he's, you know, sitting fastball, thinking fastball, and then all of a sudden it's a slider that breaks off the plate. And that's why we see a lot with Stanton in particular, where he waves at those pitches that are breaking pitches that are outside the zone, because it looks like a fastball and then it breaks off, you know, 15 inches off the plate and he's not even close to hitting the ball. So that probably has a lot to do with why we see all the time that Stanton, when he misses, it looks really, really bad.
That's the thing too. His mechanics, that all arm swing, doesn't really give him a fighting chance to adjust when he suddenly does realize it is a, you know, it's a breaking ball or it's outside of the zone. You know, it's always kind of just a linear wave at the ball, like he is anticipating fastball. So he can't really adjust.
So I think in conclusion for this part of the episode, we'll just have to find out about Stanton and hopefully it goes well for him. But he still remains a mystery and a conundrum to a certain degree. And the larger sample size will definitely let us know, obviously, where his season is going to go. So we will get into a conversation about the young guns on the Yankees right after this break. Welcome back to the Views from 314 Feet podcast. It's Randy, it's Chris, and our esteemed guest, Gary Phillips from the Daily News. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. So we've talked about these two guys in a previous episode, but I think their impact continues and warrants a larger discussion in their overall impact on where the Yankees could go this season, and that's Anthony Volpe and Oswaldo Cabrera. For me, Volpe's not surprising. I mean, I've been all in on him all of last year, even when he struggled in certain ways. I felt like something like this was coming. Obviously, if you've been listening to the pod, he was my bold prediction. Oswaldo is the big surprise to me. And we've talked a little bit in the past about the influences that has gotten him off to this really crucial start for him, an impactful start. So we don't necessarily have to get into the mechanics of what's brought him here, but in a much bigger picture and kind of forecasting. And again, as we've said earlier, it's a 10-game sample size. Things can change. It's early in the season, all those caveats. But Gary, if Volpe and Oswaldo are able to continue this production and impact both offensively and defensively, where do you think the Yankees' floor is as a team, and what's their ceiling if they're able to impact the way that they have on both sides of the ball so far?
I think it's a huge boost for the team, especially with Volpe. You know, with Oswaldo, I wonder how his role changes and his playing time changes over the course of the season as, you know, a guy like John Birdie gets more involved, as DJ LeMahieu, you know, the Yankees hope comes back in a timely manner. With Volpe, you know, this is your everyday starting shortstop, and I think it's just tremendous what he's done so far. You know, you mentioned you expected this kind of thing. I expected an improvement, you know, particularly in the contact skills, the on-base skills, but he just looks like a totally different player. Boone talked yesterday, Sunday, about how he just looked so much savvier and like a veteran and like a leader, a seasoned player. And you got to remember, he's still only 22. So, no, there might still be some more growing pains, but pitch recognition has improved. You saw on Sunday some really smart aggressive base running. You know, he's been fast. He stole bases last year, but you know, the way he did it Sunday late in the game, stealing back-to-back bags, was just very savvy. He just seems more seasoned. So I think when you're getting that regular production out of your starting shortstop, whether he's 22 or 35, that's a huge boost for your team, especially when he's adding a gold glove caliber defense. And, you know, I think it also just gives the Yankees some flexibility on offense as the season goes on. If Volpe can continue hitting like this and running like this, you know, that gives you a leadoff option if LeMahieu comes back and isn't, you know, his vintage self, which I think is a huge question mark at this point in time. Now, Torres has been seeing a lot of pitches from the leadoff spot, but he doesn't have a ton of results yet. He also doesn't have the speed that Volpe has. So if Volpe can show that this is sustainable, it has the chance to really add another dynamic, another level to the offense if he can kind of work his way up to the top of the order as the year goes on.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of people who've been saying, like, why isn't Volpe already leading off? I mean, we saw last year they did that. You know, he was hitting ninth. They moved him up to first. And then he struggled, like, as soon as that happened. I mean, there's no need to do it right now. Like, it's working where he's hitting. So there's no reason to disrupt any routines that he may have hitting where he's been, you know, in the sixth or seventh spot. So there's no need to move him up right now. It's also April, and it doesn't really matter where he's hitting. You know, if it's October, yeah, he's probably leading off because he's been the best, you know, overall hitter that the Yankees have had. So, yeah, I don't think that necessarily matters right now. I mean, I think the most interesting thing with Volpe so far is just his lack of swing and miss. Now, that was his big problem last year. He didn't really have any good pitch recognition on really any pitches, honestly. He's been getting on base a ton, which was a huge problem for him last year. I mean, I think the Yankees just needed, coming into this year, a few people to step up around Soto and Judge, because you kind of expect they're going to be great. You expect them to be top 10 hitters in the sport. It was the main question with the lineup was who's going to step up. Would it be DJ? Well, he's hurt. Rizzo, you know, he hasn't looked that great. Stanton, we already talked about him. But so far, I mean, it's been Volpe and Cabrera, which, you know, with Cabrera, like Gary said, I do wonder just where he'll fit in when DJ comes back. I would expect DJ to take over third base. I don't think that, you know, he's going to be coming off the bench. You know, I have a hard time picturing DJ coming off the bench for Cabrera. You know, I think just coming into the year anyway, they expected Cabrera to be that utility role, could play it anywhere. You know, Glaber needs a day while Cabrera can play second, or Verdugo needs a day while he can play left field, or they want him to play right field, wherever. Volpe needs a day. So I think with Cabrera, I expect his role to be, you know, a super utility guy when DJ comes back. But it is encouraging that he is hitting the way he has. You know, even in Sunday's game, he had a hit from the right side of the plate, threw the bat out. You know, Volpe was on third base. It was just really good, a really good piece of hitting just to bring Volpe in at that point in the game. But, you know, I think for the Yankees, the short term, it's great that these two guys in particular are performing. But I think long term, if they continue growing, I think that's where it becomes really important, because, you know, Volpe is 22. He's turning 23 in a couple weeks. You expect him to, you know, be with the Yankees for, you know, the next decade plus. Cabrera's 25 years old. If he continues to, you know, show out and continue improving, well, you also have another cost-controlled option that you don't have to, you know, go out in free agency and drop millions on whoever. So I think that's also important to talk about with those two guys in particular, is, you know, those guys haven't hit arbitration yet, and they're with the team for, you know, if they want, for the next, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. So I think that's also important to note with those two.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Volpe's defense, and I know that so much attention has been paid to his impact offensively and the very clear jump that he's taken at the plate. But I feel like, and I think the numbers back it up so far, there's been a jump on the field as well. And I think some of the plays he made in the Toronto series, he might have made them last year. But I remember that stretch where some plays that you feel like were a little routine, he committed an error or there was a lack of focus or whatever have you. It just seemed like he had a stretch for a while where some of the plays weren't being made. And it feels like this year on the defensive side, he's like really locked in and continuing to showcase a strong arm. I feel like his range is even better. I mean, I'm sure that there's some kind of, I'm sure we could look at OAA and DRS, and I think that those numbers will back it up. I had a quick glance at them before we got on. But even with the eye tests, it just feels like he's covering a little bit more ground. He's making he's making the routine play look routine, but he's also stepped up and made some big plays in some big spots. The play, I believe it was against Biggio. And the eighth, Kiermaier, sorry, the play in the eighth inning yesterday when he went in, up the middle and made that great play. I just feel like overall, especially on the defensive end, he's really taken a leap that's elevated the team and the team's play. And Saturday, he made a big play to kind of help stymie that rally that the Blue Jays were having. It just feels like he's a very, very influential player at the moment on both sides of the ball. Gary, is that something that you've seen as well? Is that something you picked up on, or does it feel like he's just playing like how he has last year defensively?
No, I definitely agree with you. I haven't dove into the numbers with him on defense that much, but the eye test this year compared to last year, it definitely feels like he is, I don't know if locked in is the right word, but like he is making those, routine plays. He's making those savvy plays like the ones you just mentioned, the one with Vogelbach, I think on Saturday, like you even saw him on the replay, get up, kind of like take a minute to look around, instead of just slinging the ball and possibly making like a wild throw or trying to do too much. Like he actually took a second and you can see it on the replay. Like think about what he was going to do. What was the smart thing in this situation? He recognized the runner that he had time. He makes the play. Now, last year, I think maybe he comes up firing and the ball ends up going into right field or behind the first baseman or into the stands, whatever. Last year, honestly, I think I was kind of behind the curve on all the Gold Glove talk last year. I remember Boone started talking about that seriously in maybe, I want to say, August. And my interpretation of his defense up to that point had kind of been like, yeah, he's made a lot of spectacular plays, but he also botched a lot of routine plays. He racked up a lot of errors. It seemed like there were just simple plays that he was messing up regularly. And I was like, really? Gold Glove? And then you look at the numbers and the advanced metrics and it's like, okay, yes, he's one of the best. But the eye test wasn't matching for me up to that point until I really started looking at it. This year, so far, small sample, but the eye test matches what I assume are pretty good metrics.
Yes, 100%. I never felt at any point last year that Volpe was a Gold Glove shortstop. Never. I know he won, but I didn't think quite frankly, deserved it.
He deserved it among who the eventual finalists.
Yeah,
right.
The other finalists.
I didn't think he was going to be a finalist.
Yeah, I mean, like, when the finalists came out, it was like, well, yeah, obviously Volpe's going to win. I think it was Correa and Seager, and like, they weren't really good defensively last year. I said it on a previous episode, Bobby Witt should have won the Gold Glove.
Yes.
I mean, that was really stupid. I can't believe that he wasn't a finalist and, frankly, should have won. This year, so far, Volpe looks like a Gold Glove shortstop. That wasn't the case for me last year. He had solid numbers, but like you said, Gary, the eye test just never really said, oh, okay, like this guy's legit. I mean, I honestly thought when Boone was talking to us about Volpe being in the Gold Glove conversation, it was just, a matter of a manager, you know, vouching for his player. And, you know, obviously, what else are they going to say? You know, Boone's not going to say, this guy stinks, you know, get me Oswald Peraza. Like, he's just not going to do that. So I thought it was just a matter of Boone saying, yeah, like, you know, my guy's really good. You know, he should be in the conversation, because there was nothing else that was going on that was positive at the time.
I thought almost to a certain extent, like, Boone willed Volpe's gold glove candidacy into existence. But, you know, then again, you know, he was campaigning for him toward the end of the season. Like, it wasn't just, you know, one quote and it's like, oh, okay. Like, it came up a lot as we got down the final stretch, and, you know, there wasn't much else going on positively with the Yankees. But you know what? The voters agreed. So
he's got
one, and, you know, if he keeps it up this year, he might have two.
Yeah, I mean the way he's trending, it's certainly possible. I'm looking now, you know, he's in the 94th percentile and outs above average. He already has 3 defensive runs saved. So the metrics are backing up what we're seeing with our eyes. And I think that's much different, at least for me, from what it was last year. The metrics were there, but the eye test really showed. I was like, all right, like he's good, but is he really a gold glove caliber shortstop? And I think this year that's the case.
So since you guys are around him a lot, I think it'd be great for listeners to get a better sense of your impressions of him in the locker room and how he carries himself, how he interacts with his teammates, just how his teammates react to him and treat him. Can you give us a little bit of a behind the curtain view and perspective on Anthony Volpe, the young man, how he fits in with this team, the chemistry that he has with everybody? How does he carry himself? Gary, you talked a lot about his savvy and maturity over the last year plus. Can you guys just tell us a little bit about just Anthony Volpe, the person, and how he fits in with the rest of his teammates?
Yeah, I hate to use the phrase, you know, he's a really nice kid, because it makes me sound so much older than I am. But you know, he really is a nice kid. He's a genuine kid. I still think even now in year two, there's a sense of, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here. Like, this is so amazing. You know, he's a cage rat. You know, especially before a game, you know, it's actually, and this isn't a knock or anything, but it's very rare for us to see him in the locker room before a game and to be able to get a extended interview with him, because he's almost never at his locker. If you go down the tunnel and out toward the field, he's almost always taking cuts before the game. So he's very serious about his work. I kind of get the sense from some of the Yankees' older veterans that he's close with, like Anthony Rizzo and Aaron Judge. There's like, you know, they're kind of like protective big brothers, and, you know, steering him in the right direction all the time, looking out for him, that sort of thing. So there's very much this like aura of, ooh, like he's the kid who's just happy to be here. And it's definitely a different vibe than, I guess, some of the more established players in the locker room.
Yeah. I mean, the veterans have definitely taken him under their wings. You mentioned Judge and Rizzo. He's really close with those guys. I mean, I think he's just well respected in the locker room overall, just with how he conducts himself. Like Gary said, he takes his work very seriously. He's like always working on something when we have eyes on him. He's always trying to learn. You know, it's the cliche, it's like he's a coach's son almost, just the way he conducts his business. But yeah, he's very, very nice guy. Not very talkative with the media, which stinks. You know, he can be a tough interview just because he is very quiet, but it's fine. You know, he's very nice. He's approachable. You know, I do appreciate that, but you know, I do wish that he would come out of his shell a little bit. It kind of feels like he's definitely taking that aspect from Judge. You know, Judge is very much in his shell, usually, like when he speaks with the media, especially in a group setting. And Volpe's kind of the same way. In a group setting, it's extremely difficult to get much insight from him when he is talking in a group. Even in one-on-one situations, I feel like a lot of the times he has his guard up. He's like very cautious of like saying the wrong thing, which is, you know, totally okay if you say the wrong thing. No one's perfect, obviously, but it does feel like he is very cautious of what he says with us.
Yeah, you mentioned Judge, and like I think in one-on-one situations you can get him to be, you know, open up a little bit more or be a little colorful. Like Volpe, it doesn't matter if it's a group or if it's a one-on-one. Like
that's fair.
He just doesn't say anything, you know, of substance. Not that he's rude or will decline the interview or tell you to get lost. Like if you see him, he'll usually agree if he has the time. It's just that he's not saying that much, particularly when it's questions about himself. You know, he doesn't want to talk of whether it's going well or going poorly. Like he just does not want to talk about himself. If you ask him a question about his mechanics or his mindset or his success, you know, it's instantly becomes about the team, or he highlights somebody else who did well that day, which, you know, is awesome. You know, I get a guy wants to come off as a team player and doesn't want to seem self-absorbed, but when we're trying to get some insight and clarity on, you know, how did he make these changes? Well, it's a little hard when he's not willing to talk about it.
Sounds like
you're right.
Sounds like another shortstop that wore Yankees pinstripes at one point in his life. So that sounds very familiar to me. And despite or unlike Anthony Volpe, a lot of you had a lot of things to say in the mailbox this week. So we will take this quick break and then we'll be back with your questions on the Views from 314 Feet podcast. And we're back with the Views from 314 Feet podcast. Again, it's Randy, it's Chris and Gary from the Daily News. And as always, we're thankful for your questions. Thanks for emailing them to us. It makes it easier for me. That's why I asked you guys to email, so I can just go to one spot instead of jumping around and having all this dead air. So that's the context of the email and why I asked to do it that way. So thank you for doing that for me. First question from Ryan Garcia. Ryan, thank you for supporting the podcast. Go follow Ryan on Twitter. His question is an interesting one. It's still very early, but now that we have two turns through the rotation, what is your power ranking of each of the five starters? So, Gary, we'll start with you. How would you rank the five Yankee starters so far this in this early junction of the season?
I think Stroman is obviously got to be number one. I think Cortez, who is pitching tonight before we record this podcast, has pretty clearly been fifth. And then, you know, in between, it's kind of up for grabs. You know, I've been impressed with what Rodon has done so far. I've been really impressed with what Luis Gil has shown, even though, you know, he's been a little erratic in these first two starts. That fastball is really special. The secondary stuff looks night and day compared to, you know, what it was when he debuted a couple years ago. So I've been pretty impressed there. Yeah, I think it's kind of a toss-up between one and five. But right now, I think the guy with the most concern is Cortez. I don't know if, Chris, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. Stroman's obviously one. I would have Carlos two. You know, his stuff has been great, which is good to see. It's just, can he, you know, rein in his command? If his command gets to where he wants it to be, you know, I think he can be the pitcher that the Yankees thought they were signing in free agency a couple years ago. I think last I checked, he was one of the leaders in stuff plus, which is very encouraging to see with Carlos. So I would have Carlos number two. I would have Luis Gil three. Same thing. Stuff's unbelievable. Can he just get his command to where he wants it to be? If not, I do think it's possible that, you know, when Cole comes back, he's a candidate to, you know, be in that Michael King role, especially now that Loaiza is out for the year. He'll makes perfect sense in a multi-inning role out of the bullpen. They did that with Johnny Brito late in the season. That worked out really well. You know, I think Heal has the potential to be much better than what Brito was last year. And Brito was really good in that role when King went to the starting rotation. So I think, you know, there was a question with the bullpen, just the usage. I think long-term, Heal makes perfect sense to come out of the bullpen just with where his stuff is. And the lack of command that he has in the rotation, he's been fine so far. Just, I think it's a little concerning, just his inability to find the strike zone on occasion. Clark Schmidt is 4. I've been a little disappointed with Clark so far. You know, we talked about him in episode 1. I thought he would take the next step. Obviously it's early. He can still take the step. He just hasn't shown that yet. And then Nestor is 5. I have not been impressed at all with Nestor. I know he's bounced back after the first couple of innings. He's struggled in both starts. I just don't see it with him right now. I think his stuff is lacking. His fastball is not the same as it was in 2022. Not even velocity, just the movement that he's had. I think out of all the pitchers, he's the one I'm most concerned with so far. And I know coming into the season in spring training, he didn't have the results, but I said that he was the one I was least concerned with. And now I'm most concerned with him after 2 starts. But, you know, I think with Nestor, I don't really know what the issue is, because last year it was, you know, the third time through the order, getting deep into games. Now it's like the first inning, you know, teams are getting on him early and then he's settling in. But yeah, it's just, the stuff just looks a little flat to me. You know, there's, I guess, optimism that you can improve your stuff over the course of the year, but through 2 starts, it's a little concerning. I think I would be extremely concerned if he goes into tonight's start. Again, we're recording early Monday. If he goes out in tonight's start and can't get through like 5 and like shuts them down, because the Marlins lineup stinks.
It's terrible.
They suck. They're terrible.
They gotta be a smooth one.
They have no juice. They have nothing. If he struggles against this lineup, you know, again, any major league lineup can go off for sure. But for the Yankees and for Nestor, he is their number one starter right now. He's got to go out and dominate this lineup, because that lineup's trash. And if he doesn't, I would have legitimate concerns of just where he stands right now.
I wonder.
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
No, I just, and this is just a random thought. This isn't based on like any reporting or anything I know, but I wonder if, you know, once Cole comes back and the rotation is, you know, the Yankees hope whole at that point, like, does Cortez and Heal become kind of a tandem? You know, whether one's starting, the other is not. They're 2 very, very different looks in terms of stuff. You know, that could be an interesting way to get you through a game, spare your, you know, traditional relievers, so to speak. Just a thought that occurred to me.
Oh, that's a good thought for sure, especially with how different of pitchers they are. You know, the Yankees usually don't go with a 6-man rotation, but they could go with that piggyback situation that you're talking about, where, you know, if it's Heal starts the first 4 innings, or Nestor's, you know, been starting, so he's probably the obvious choice to start the game, to like have a traditional role. He goes 4 innings or whatever, and then Heal comes in and, you know, pitches the rest of the game if he's able to. I think that would certainly be an interesting strategy that the Yankees could look at for sure, especially if Nestor is, you know, continuing to flounder a little bit. I like the sound of it on paper. I don't know if it's viable to actually put into use, but because of how different they are, it would be interesting.
I was actually thinking the reverse. You know, you leave Heal in the rotation or as the starter because he hasn't done bullpen work before. Cortez has. And then, you know, Nestor, if he continues to struggle in the first inning, well, you can give him a soft landing by having him come in against the bottom of an order. Or because he's a lefty, you can play matchups and bring him in dependent on that. Just a quirky idea.
Yeah, my rankings are the same as Chris's rankings, and I'm projecting here. I'm going a little bit further down the road. I think the Yankees are going to need to get a starter, and they're going to have to figure out what they're going to do with Nestor. I mean, I've been totally unimpressed with Nestor. I've had concerns about Nestor, and I have even more concerns now. It's not just the stuff; it's the command. I think he's just had poor performances, and I haven't seen anything that you can take from the starts that's encouraging to say, okay, well, at least he has this to build on. I haven't seen it at all. And he's faced two types of lineups too. Like the Houston lineup, super powerful, dynamic at the top. Arizona, obviously a different offensive profile from Houston. And I don't think he looked good against either lineup, you know, and they just presented different challenges, and he couldn't really navigate through either lineup really well. I think I would prefer to keep Heel in the rotation if I had to choose, just because I think the stuff is there, and I think that there's an opportunity for him to improve his command. I think what happened yesterday with him was Angel Hernandez, and I think that that was more a sign of inexperience in youth and not being able to navigate your emotions when things are not going your way, even though you think that you've executed a pitch, more so than like a larger concern about his command. And I know that that's always going to be a thing for him until he proves that he can have strong command consistently. But I think part of yesterday was really about Angel Hernandez and how awful of an umpire he is. And I think he'll kind of like let all of that get to him, because even, you know, he wasn't engaging with the hitters. Like, it just seemed like things were unraveling for him on the emotional side.
I agree with that.
And I could be wrong. Again, it's only two starts. He has more than enough time to get things in order. But Cortez, like, genuinely concerns me when he pitches. And I don't feel super confident that he can navigate through this, like, trash Marlins lineup. You know, that's where I'm at with him right now. I don't have a lot of confidence in Nestor, and hopefully that changes. I'm a fan of Nestor. But he's a distant five for me in my power rankings. I think Schmidt can figure some things out. Maybe he's just like a slow starter. He did this last year where he wasn't great at the beginning of the year, and then things started to click for him, and then he improved as the season went on. Maybe that's just how he operates and navigates the season. And I agree with everybody's rankings with Rodon and Stroman. But Cortez feels like – I think there's like an issue there that's not going to get much better. And maybe the piggyback thing happens and it helps him. But I think at some point they're going to have to bring somebody in. Like, and I'm, you know, it's obviously a guess here, but I just have concerns about Nestor. There's nothing that I've seen over the last year now that makes me feel good about where he's at. So
I feel like I'm like slightly higher on Schmidt's first two starts than you guys are, it sounds
like. Well, I liked his first start.
Yeah, I thought he was way better than the line against Houston. Yeah.
And I agree with that.
And I thought he did a solid job the other night in really chilly, windy conditions. You know, he talked about that a little bit after the game and how the cold and the wind was hurting him. I think you saw it really hurt Gausman, and, you know, he didn't make the adjustments. He also didn't have the velocity. So you wonder what's up with him. But, yeah, I'm not so down on Schmidt's first two starts. And I went into the year thinking he'll probably have a – thinking he would have a big year.
No, that's fair. I mean, I don't want to – I think it's just the third time through the order thing. Like, seeing
still if he can concern. Actually
– yeah. I mean, that's what it is. Like, just please get through, you know, third time through the order – and I think that he would have taken the next step. I'm a fan of Clark Schmidt, so I don't want to come across like I feel about him the way I feel about Nestor. Like Nestor, I have concerns. I'm not really that concerned about Clark Schmidt. All right, let's go to the next question from Andrew Tweedy. And this is something that I've seen on social media a bunch since the Yankees' patience at the plate has improved so far in the early goings of the season. This is about James Rousen. Rousen, right? I'm pronouncing it correctly, right?
Yep.
Okay. James Rousen has been popping up sort of on the fringes of this conversation, but I feel like his impact might be getting lost in all of the Soto discussion. Is this old school approach of a more pure approach to grinding out at bats something he has brought with him throughout his career? In other words, do you think the lineup would have made this kind of philosophical shift regardless of the Soto acquisition?
I want to answer that by kind of dispelling this notion that I keep seeing, not just in this question, but also on social media and conversations, like dispelling this notion that he's strictly this old school hitting coach and that, you know, all his philosophies are pre-analytics or anti-analytics. Like, he made it really clear, you know, I don't think the Yankees at this point would go with anything else. Like, he's made it pretty clear that he is balanced. He's got old school and he's got new school. He knows the analytics, but he knows that they're not for everybody. He knows how to communicate. He knows how to tailor his, you know, an approach or his coaching and advice to an individual, which I think that more than anything was an issue last year. You know, it was kind of one size fits all, and you know, that happened to, you know, the shoe happened to just be analytics from an analytically, driven coach and Dylan Lawson. Then you have Sean Casey come in. He doesn't really have any coaching experience whatsoever, but you know, he's rah-rah, he's energetic. You saw that didn't lead to different results. So I think this, fans want to drive this wedge between old school, new school, when really I think it's a matter of finding a middle ground of being able to communicate both sides. And I think James is doing a very good job of that so far.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that James mentioned the first time we spoke with him is, you know, some guys like having so much information and they can't be overwhelmed with it. And then other guys want little information or, you know, just the basics. And sometimes guys have different terms they use when discussing certain statistics or analytic terms like exit velocity or launch angle. You know, some guys say, oh, like I'm pulling the ball, you know, too much in the air or something. And other guys will say launch angle. It's just like different things like that were not being communicated well with Lawson. It was just, you know, one size fits all approach. You know, I think that's the main difference so far with James. He is certainly analytical. You know, he's coming from two teams, the Twins and the Tigers, who are very, very analytical organizations. And like Gary said, the Yankees are not hiring someone who is anti-analytics. Like, they're a very analytical organization themselves. Yes, there's a mixture of, you know, pro scouting and all that stuff, but to be clear, they are very analytical. So they're not hiring someone who doesn't believe in that stuff. I think for the approach at the plate, I think it's also just a matter of they have a lot of veterans in their lineup who know how to work counts. Like it looks different for sure. But, you know, you add someone like Soto to the lineup, a healthier Anthony Rizzo who works counts. We talked about Volpe. He's obviously much improved from last year, and it was his rookie season. Cabrera, we talked about. Austin Wells, who we haven't mentioned, it obviously looks much better at the plate. I know he doesn't have results, but if you look under the hood, there's a lot of very encouraging stuff going on with Wells. Alex Verdugo is someone who doesn't strike out. So, like, you just naturally have guys in the order this year who weren't in the order last year or who are much improved. It's going to look different. So I don't think it's James saying, go up there, take three pitches, you know, swing at the fourth. I think sometimes fans like get carried away with that stuff. It's not like Little League where, you know, you're getting the take sign on the first pitch because your coach thinks like the guy can't throw strikes. Like, that's not happening here. I think it's just natural that the Yankees have different guys in their order this year. They have a few guys who are much improved from last year, and that's why you're seeing much better at bats. It has nothing to do with Rousey.
And that idea of work the count, control the zone, you know, grind down the pitcher, like that's something Boone has talked about forever. You know, that can kind of be traced even back to like the Savages and the Box Rant. And, you know, I mean, this is not a new thing that Boone just wanted to implement implement this season. I kind of asked him the other day, like, or maybe it was in Arizona, you know, how does that change from year to year? And he kind of said, without being so direct, like, we didn't have the guys that were capable last year. You know, when everybody's, when Judge is on the AIL and Rizzo is out and Stanton's out and Donaldson's, you know, a shell of himself, you know, like he was kind of, he kind of just said like, yeah, we didn't have guys capable of grinding down pitchers last year.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I'll contribute to this is the whole philosophy thing of grinding at bats is Stick Michael. I mean, this has been a Yankee staple for decades. I mean, this is, it's not anything new. It's not anything that's been, that needed to be reintroduced. They always wanted to do it, but as you said, Gary, I mean, they just didn't have the guys that were capable of doing it consistently. So, I mean, this is, that's a Yankee staple with Stick Michael and Buck Showalter. I mean, that's been around forever. So, I don't think Rowson's, not to say that that's what the question is hinting at, but I don't think Rowson's reinventing the wheel with that approach. So, thank you for your question, Andrew. And our last question is from David Simon. And this kind of goes back to pitching, but thinking on something a little bit different, especially with the rash of pitching injuries that's been going on throughout the entire league. And the Yankees have obviously been hit by that as well. Based on the uptick in arm injuries and the current starters not being able to go much more than five innings, what should the focus of the pitching and the minors be? Try and get guys who can do multiple innings in relief versus keeping them stretched out to start in case of Beater and Warren. What are the best ways for them to go about doing this? I think it's an interesting question, especially given the context of what's been happening throughout the entire league. But Chris, what do you think about how the Yankees should approach their upper level minor league pitchers and in the context of, you know, pitcher management and injuries and all those things?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've actually spoken about with Matt Blake. The value of a pitcher just increases tremendously if they can start games. Like the more starters you have in your organization, the better off, because you can always move them eventually to the bullpen. Like I think Clayton Beater, I don't think he's a starter in the major leagues, but you know they're gonna keep him built up in the minors because that holds value. Will Warren, I think he is a starter. There are certain guys across the organization who are starters, but they're probably not going to end up starting long-term with the Yankees or even maybe anywhere else across the sport. But the more pitchers you have who are built up, the better off you are long-term. And just looking at it from a contractual observation, starting pitchers get more money than relief pitchers. The more quality starting pitchers you have in your organization, the better off you are, because like I just said, you know, you can always move these guys to the bullpen, and sometimes their stuff is even better out of the bullpen because they're pitching only one or two innings. So the more pitchers you have who can provide length, the better off you are as an organization.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. You know, I think it's an individual case by case basis. You know, a guy like Warren, the Yankees have been pretty adamant he is a starter. A guy like Beater, you know, they haven't been so emphatic about that. And obviously you saw him start the season in the bullpen. Now it goes back down. He's kind of going to stay built up. It's way easier to go from the rotation to the pen than the pen to the rotation, especially if you have to do it in a timely manner in the event of an injury or something like that at the major league level. So you want to keep these guys built up. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot of injuries going around right now, and that's obviously a huge concern, but that doesn't mean you just stop developing starting pitchers.
Right. And hopefully at some point this season, we'll be able to bring on someone in particular who can really like get into that question for us. Fingers crossed that we can get him on the podcast. But I do think it's interesting. And I do think the whole conversation of pitching injuries is fascinating because there's so many things that go into it, even on the development side and how you approach it as an organization. I think all of that is really compelling and fascinating. But I agree with you guys. I don't really have much more to add to that conversation. So thank you, everyone, for your questions. I know that there was a Stanton question, but I feel like we covered that pretty well in our first segment. So hopefully that question was answered. And before we go, obviously, we have two great journalists with us. Gary's been doing great work over at the Daily News, especially with stories that go beyond what's happening on the field and with the team on a day-to-day basis. And really like your story on Soto, multiple stories on Soto and impact at the Dominican Academy, and your great story on Ashley Rodon and Carlos Rodon and their IVF decision. So Gary and Chris, you guys are unique in the sense that you kind of, not kind of, but you tell stories that go beyond the very obvious with the day in, day out game of baseball. And as a filmmaker who also tries to do that with his work and try to expand it into different avenues, I appreciate it. So can you guys talk a little bit? And we don't have that much time left because we want people to go on about their day. But can you guys talk about your process and why you guys like to approach these stories with those angles? Why is that important to you? Why do you think that's important for readers? Can you just talk a little bit about your process and your beliefs and philosophies in telling these types of stories around these athletes?
Yeah, so for me, it's like we have this very unique, cool job and opportunity to tell readers about who these players are as people. You know, a lot of fans are going to watch the games. They're going to read the box scores and all that. But, you know, Chris and I and the rest of the beat, we have a chance to tell you who these people are that, you know, fans otherwise wouldn't necessarily know. And obviously we only get to do that to a certain extent. You know, we're never going to truly know who a person is off the field or in the privacy of their own home or anything like that, but we can try chipping away and opening that up a little bit. So for one, you know, to me, that's important. It's important just on an interest level. Like, I think it's interesting for readers and it's interesting for me. I can only write, you know, so many recaps about, 10-0 game in the middle of the summer and not get stale and still be amused with my work. So for me, you know, there's definitely a personal motivation as well. And then as far as just like the process, like, I don't know, for me, it's kind of just paying attention to things and not only with the Yankees and inside the clubhouse, but also in the real world. You know, I've always thought since I started doing this in college, it's really important to be a well-rounded person if I want to be a really good sports reporter. I know a lot of people would say, you know, stick to sports or, you know, keep politics, keep, you know, social affairs out of it, stuff like that. But if I'm not paying attention to what's going on beyond baseball, one, I'm kind of going to be an idiot as a person. Two, it's going to, you know, prevent me from tracking down all these different ideas, you know, like, you brought up the story on the Rodons and in vitro fertilization. You know, that story started or came about because, you know, last year I had written this story on the Rodons and mental health, and Ashley had told me about her miscarriages, and it turned into like this really nice feature. Over the off season, they start up a grant for IVF because that was an option that had been presented to them during her pregnancy struggles. They didn't use it, but it gave them a lot of hope. So she reached out to me over the offseason and was like, hey, we're doing this. It'd be really cool if you wrote about it. You know, our charity, essentially. They had an event, like a launch event, the day before the winter meeting. So my mind was elsewhere. The travel wasn't going to work out. Just a lot of conflicts. It wasn't at the top of mind. Earlier this year, you know, you have the Alabama Supreme Court ruling where it's like, wow, IVF is suddenly in the news everywhere, every single day. It's become a hot button political issue, which, you know, a couple months ago you would have never imagined. So I circled back with Ashley and I said, hey, if you still are interested in having this written about, I'm into it, but it's not just going to be, you know, look at this charity, look at this grant and the great things you're doing. Like, will you engage with the political and the religious
discourse that's surrounding this issue right now. And to her credit and to Carlos's credit, they were totally willing and happy to do it, which I thought made for a really good story and something really interesting. But you know, they always tell you, like in school, how do you localize, you know, or centralize a national issue to your beat? So like that was an example of me trying to do it and looking for a unique way to do so. And you know, those are the stories I enjoy writing the most. Like I kind of think at the end of the day, just about anybody with a little bit of training and a pair of eyes can write about what happens on the field or recap a game, stuff like that. Going beyond the field, beyond the lines, takes a little bit of an extra effort, a little bit extra curiosity. And for me, that's what it comes down to. Like, I just want to be curious and I want chances to learn things I don't necessarily know. And I think Chris does a lot, you know, feels the same way and certainly does a great job of executing it.
Yeah. I mean, one, also the season is so long that it's too much to write about the same stuff every single day. It's easy to do the injury updates and what happened in the game or how this player's looking. Like, you need something to just, you know, keep you motivated also, because it's baseball, covering baseball is a grind because of how long it is. So you want to try and do something different than what the others on the beat are doing, or, you know, just across the league in general. It's just much easier to get caught up with the day to day. So you just have to find unique angles. And that's, those are the stories I really do enjoy telling. 'Cause like Gary said, like, you do want to, you know, show fans like who they are as people off the field. You want fans to know like insight of like how something changed in like their swing. Like that stuff is also interesting to me. Like, you know, the story I did with Oswaldo and you know, how he changed his mindset just by watching Juan Soto up close in person. So those are the kinds of stories that, you know, I really do enjoy and I think are important to share with readers. You know, I also work for a paywall subscription site. Like, everything is under a paywall, so the stories I have to come up with have to be interesting or different, because, you know, people are paying money to read the stories I write.
So as someone that reads both of your work, again, thank you. I appreciate them a great deal. Subscribe to The Athletic, read the daily news, buy the paper. Like, go to the newsstand.
Gotta subscribe to us too. Unfortunately, now everything's behind a paywall there also.
Buy the paper, subscribe to the Daily News, subscribe to The Athletic, support Chris and Gary. They are great writers, and I think that in all sincerity, Yankees fans are very blessed to have the both of you and the entire Yankees beat. I think I read other beats for other teams, and people will accuse me of bias. I don't really care. I think you guys and the Yankees beat it are at the top. So thank you both for that. Thank you, Gary, for joining us and being our first guest on the Views from 314 Feet podcast. It was great to have you. Thank you for your insight. Open invitation as that lady just walks by you and sets up shop.
I'm in a common space right now, but thanks. Yeah, no, it's fine. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, and Chris, thank you once again. Great conversation. Any last words before we get out of here?
No, I think Gary and I actually have to start getting ready to head to the stadium soon.
Yeah, I got
it. Gary's got to drive.
I got a much longer commute than Chris does. Yes,
oh, wow. Does. Okay. Don't drive during the eclipse. Might be an issue for you guys.
Yeah, I got some glasses for us for a couple other of the writers, so we won't be going blind.
Nice.
Perfect. All right. I was actually upset that I didn't have glasses, so perfect.
Nice. Your boy's looking out for you.
You can thank Amy. I
will. So thank you, everybody, for checking us out. Again, this is episode 3 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms, and we are now on YouTube. So you can watch us, and you can watch the people behind Gary as they get ready for a meeting. We are on YouTube. The channel is the same name, Views from 314 Feet podcast. Please subscribe on the podcast platforms and YouTube. We're thankful for all of you supporting us. It's very exciting. And we will speak to you guys next week.